It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Julie Rose, in for Mike Collins. The disturbing details of North Carolina's eugenics program have been widely reported recently. Thousands of men, women, and children as young as 10 were sterilized by the state of North Carolina against their will up into the mid-70s. This is not ancient history, and yet by the summer of 2002, it had been all but forgotten. Then a reporter at the Winston-Salem Journal stumbled on an obscure reference to it in the footnote of an academic journal, of all places. And that led to an explosive series laying bare the shocking truth of eugenics in North Carolina. It's only now that lawmakers are on the verge of compensating those victims. So why has it taken 10 years? And for that matter, how could the entire eugenics program have been so quickly and so easily forgotten once it ended in the mid-1970s? I'm joined now by two of the reporters who first uncovered the story for the Winston-Salem Journal. That series, Against Their Will, has been compiled into a new book. You can find details about that online at WFAE.org. John Rayleigh and Scott Sexton are both still with the Winston-Salem Journal, and they join us from Winston-Salem by phone. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Julie.
Hi. So later in the program, we'll also talk with House Speaker Tom Tillis, who has made it a priority to get victims compensated. And we'll also hear from one of the original North Carolina victims to come forward and tell her story. Starting with you first, Scott and John, tell us a little about that first clue that led you down this path. And what did you think when you first started uncovering these eugenics documents back in 2002?
It was hard to believe that that something like that could have gone on until the early 1970s. I mean, Kevin brought this footnote back and explained a little bit about what he had uncovered and explained that it had gone on in 33 other states, most of whom had curtailed theirs after World War II, and North Carolina continued to ramp theirs up to the 50s and the 60s, and it was really hard to fathom that we participated in such a thing.
Scott, can we have you talk up just a little bit there? You're a little soft for us. And Kevin, you mentioned Kevin. That's Kevin Bigos. He was another reporter that was with your team at the time?
That's correct. He was in Washington, D.C. at the time at a science conference, I think at Woods Hole in Massachusetts, looking at something completely different when he saw this footnote.
So when you're discovering this, I mean, this is historical information. There were actually articles written about this, you know, prior to the 1970s. I mean, it must have felt a little strange to be uncovering something that you and people around you had never heard of, and yet it had been pretty widely discussed only just a few decades ago.
Yes, Julie, the thing about it was hiding in plain sight. I mean, they sterilized their very story, the Eugenics Board. They would issue these cheery press releases, and our paper and many others just basically rewrote the press releases. So the brutal inner workings of the program were never exposed until Kevin got that tip, and we did our series.
And was there ever a time, though, that you two, as you were digging into this, that maybe you were doubting? You say it was hard to believe. Was there a time where you thought, maybe we've got this wrong? I mean, maybe we've missed something here. Maybe this isn't really what we think it is.
Yes, when Scott first told me about it, he said, let's go out to the loading dock and talk. And he said, you know, our state, we've got this information. Our state had this forced sterilization program. And I'm like, bull, BS. We did not. This was Terry Sanford's North Carolina. This did not go on here. And so it was just like unpeeling an onion, you know. It was just like we were shocked every day at what we were finding.
Tell me what you remember some of the early things that you uncovered, you know, for those who may not know some of the details. What was it that really sort of just knocked you back in your seat?
The way it progressed is what was truly shocking. The numbers were there. We sterilized the third most citizens behind California and Virginia, but the way ours unfolded and as we crunched the numbers and got a hold of the data and saw that it increasingly turned toward the poor and African American population, it was staggering to see how these local eugenics boards went after people, the most vulnerable people we have in the state.
What was the first thread, I guess, that you pulled when you first started to dig into this? You know, was it going to try and find the people who had done this or the victims who had experienced it?
Yes, my job was to find the victims, and we knew from the start that we had to put a human face on it, that it was all about the victims, but they had just disappeared. And So I got references to Niall Ramirez and Elaine Riddick, and eventually I tracked them down, and they were like, they've been waiting to tell their story all these years. So we, and they were both, it was this amazing little thing of they had both grown up on the coastal plain within like 30 minutes of each other, but had never met. They both left North Carolina so mad at it and moved to New York, and then they both moved to the Atlanta area. And the things they told us were just amazing about being bullied into these operations.
You also spoke with, we're hoping to speak with Elaine Riddick here in the next little bit on this program, but you also, during your research, spoke with members of the Eugenics Board, right? These individuals who were basically government bureaucrats who were issuing these orders that people be sterilized for various reasons. What were those encounters like?
Right. Again, it was like, you know, these people were like friends of family, friends in my case, for some of the people. So it was kind of like it was painful to ask them these hard questions, but they had to be asked. And the thing was, the Eugenics Board was they were de facto, like you had the attorney general, you had the heads of the state hospitals. So they weren't appointed by the governor. So you didn't have a lot of, you know, you didn't have the political appointment process that would have brought more of a watchdog thing on who was being appointed, what this board was doing. So it was kind of like this ugly glacier, just, you know, sliding on for generation after generation with little public notice.
Tell me a little bit about the motivation, I guess, of this program. I mean, what was it that the members of the Eugenics Board and, I guess, the state, the lawmakers who created it, what were they trying to accomplish with this?
Well, they were operating under basically junk science. They thought that they were doing right. They believed in the science of the day, and you know, it had overtones of Nazi Germany. They thought they were getting less desirable elements out of the population looking down the road. It was a bizarre social experiment, and it's almost genetic engineering in the way. Take the feeble-minded. That's a term they actually used. They said, you know, people with IQs under 75, 70 should not be allowed to have children. It's staggering when you look at it through what we know today.
You know, we think about eugenics with regard to Nazi Germany. I mean, was this a lesson that North Carolina had somehow picked up from the Nazis?
Well, the thing was that this was part of a nationwide movement at creating this superior race of people, at improving bloodlines, and that as my friend Edwin Black, the author of War Against the Weak, has just nailed down repeatedly, is that, you know, contrary to popular belief, Americans taught the Germans about genocide and eugenics and sterilization, not vice versa.
You mean it originated here and was handed off to Hitler and his...
Yes, in America, the Carnegie Foundation and others were sending... supposed scientists over to tutor these guys in the whole eugenics stuff.
Scott, we're speaking with Scott Sexton and John Rayleigh with the Winston-Salem Journal, who were on that original reporting team that published the groundbreaking series Against Their Will about North Carolina's eugenics program in 2002. And Scott, you mentioned earlier that you were shocked to discover the size, the scope of North Carolina's program, that I think more than 7,600 people had been ordered sterilized by the Eugenics Board in North Carolina. Why was North Carolina's board so active? What led to such high numbers? Was it just that we're a larger state, so it's a, you know, a population ratio kind of a thing?
My belief is that it was because of some of the more prominent citizens of the state. In Winston-Salem, surprisingly enough, some of the names you, Reynolds Tobacco, some of the people associated with the hospital here, were behind it and pushed it, and they formed an organization that they called the Human Betterment League. And it was at the upper echelons of society and the power brokers in the state that really sort of pushed this idea based upon this junk science. They thought they were doing the right thing. Later on, of course, found out they were 180 degrees wrong, but that's why I believe we were way up there in terms of the number of people.
That's one of the things that I find sort of complicated about this story, is that I think as I've done some reporting on this as well, from our view today, it seems so monstrous and that these people on the eugenics board must have been monsters to want to try and do this. You know, it sounds so wrong. And yet there truly was a feeling. In fact, here in Mecklenburg County, where most of the sterilizations took place, maybe you can talk a little bit to this. I mean, the health director here in Mecklenburg County, Mr. Kuralt, was, you know, he talked a lot also about feeling like he was helping these women to have control of their own reproductive health. So is that, do you think, one of the reasons why it was not initially seen as this terrible thing and we should obviously not be doing this?
Well, yeah, Julie, I think, you know, in the 20s, 30s, maybe early 40s, yes, you can see that progressives were, you know, saw it as a good thing and that, you know, they thought they were doing right. But, you know, by the 1960s, when almost every other American state is realizing the folly of this and backing off, and North Carolina charges ahead and shifts its target, which had been proportionate to the general population, and they start going for black women and girls on welfare, yeah, something's terribly wrong there. And that's beyond being well intentions gone awry. That becomes something very wrong.
What did state lawmakers, what was their reaction when you started speaking to them about this, trying to get official, I guess, state officials from the governor on down, getting their reaction to what you had uncovered?
Well, from the very start, you know, easily apologized the day our series ended. So that was encouraging, and we didn't know what a long, long road we were embarking on to try to get justice for these folks.
That was former Governor Mike Easley there that you're
yeah.
mentioning. Did they initially just believe it and say, oh, yeah, well, I've known about this all along? I mean, what were those initial conversations like?
Well, there was actually a sense of disbelief. They didn't want to believe the size and scope. The records of the Eugenics Board were actually sealed up for a while. We were able to obtain some redacted copies and go through, and we had proof from the state that it did in fact exist. But there was some initial disbelief. And some of the original lawmakers, like Democratic State Representative Larry Womble from here in Winston-Salem, jumped on it hard early because they saw what had been done to the African-American community, were pushing initiatives. They were outraged, correctly, and it took some of the others a while to get on board.
What did you think would happen as a result of this series?
We knew inherently that something had to be done for these folks, that they needed justice. And for me, it was a natural thing to start pushing for them as I shifted from becoming an editorial writer and then as the editorial page editor, sitting in the same chair where back in the day guys had supported this program in editorials. And we were lucky enough as Scott was saying, that Representative Larry Womble took the calls and ran with it and his fault. He's often been a lone voice, though, in the legislature, even from his own Democratic Party. And so that's why we've been so encouraged by Tom Tillis taking it up and trying to get justice for these folks. And it'll be 10 years in December from the time the series came out. And some of these folks have died along the way. I talk to these folks every day. Others are hurting mentally and physically, and it would just be shameful if it doesn't happen this session, because if it doesn't, it'll never happen with the change in the legislature and a new governor.
I'm a little more cynical than John. I didn't think anything would happen. I was amazed that Governor Easley stepped forward to apologize. Only one other governor in Oregon, I believe, had apologized for a similar type program.
Hold on right there, Scott. We got to take a break. We'll come right back, and we'll have Tom Tillis with us from the North Carolina House. Charlotte Talks, WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carpe Diem Restaurant and Caterers, offering full-service catering for wedding receptions, corporate events, or other life celebrations for over 23 years. More information at CarpeDiemRestaurant.com. And Carolinas Healthcare System, offering total joint replacement at its Hip and Knee Center, located at Carolinas Medical Center, Mercy. More information at cmc-mercy.org/hip-and-knee. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, summer travel season is underway, and we have some rather unique ideas on where to go and how to get there in an affordable way. Several travel experts will join guest host Chris Clackham with insights on sights to see, here, there, and everywhere. Hit the road with us on Charlotte Talks. It's Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Thank you.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, you'll hear top journalists give meaning to the week's national headlines. Take a look back at what happened, how it affects your world. The Friday News Roundup. Join us.
Join the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source. We're back. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Julie Rose, in for Mike Collins. And we're talking with John Rayleigh and Scott Sexton of the Winston-Salem Journal. They were part of the original reporting team that brought the full extent of North Carolina's eugenics program to light in 2002. You can share your thoughts with us online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Just before the break, Scott, you were saying that you didn't think much would happen, that as disturbing as these details were, that you were revealing back in 2002, you really never thought that the state would do anything about this?
No, I didn't. In fact, I figured we had some resistance within our own organization at the paper. People looked at us like, well, this is old news. What's new about this? Why report this now? It was yesterday, and I thought, sincerely, that would be the attitude of the lawmakers in Raleigh, too. I mean, what can we do about it? This was done well before our time, other than possibly issue an apology.
Well, it's been 10 years since that series was published, and it does look as though we are to on the verge of doing something in North Carolina about this. So to talk a little more about that, we're joined by North Carolina House Speaker Tom Tillis. He is a key sponsor of the measure to compensate eugenics victims. It calls for a $50,000 lump sum payment to each living victim who comes forward. Speaker Tillis, thank you so much for being with us this morning on Charlotte Talks. Speaker Tillis, can you hear us? Oh, looks like we've lost him. We'll get him right back on the line. Scott, I want to just go back to you and John for just a minute. I mean, was there ever any thought about compensation? I mean, what about other states? Has compensating victims ever actually been part of the discussion when it comes to eugenics programs in the U.S.?
No, and as hard as we get on our state for dragging its heels for 10 years, I mean, we've still gone further on this than any other American state. I mean, California won't even talk about it, and they, you know, led the nation. So we'd be the first American state to do this. A few foreign countries have done it, but we would definitely be the first American state. But that would make sense because we were one of the most aggressive programs in the country.
Now, over these last 10 years, there have been bills introduced in the North Carolina House to compensate victims. You mentioned Democratic Representative Larry Wambola of Forsyth County. What has happened to those bills over the years? Why haven't they gotten as far as we've gotten now with this current piece of legislation?
It was kind of a perfect storm of the economy and of political corruption. Of course, Easley's problems surfaced after he left office. But, you know, in the final, and Larry, as I said, was basically given lip service by his own party. His bills never made it out of committee, despite how hard he fought for them and for the victims. But, you know, and it's really just wrong to say the economy. They've been told that for 10 years. And meanwhile, some of them have died and others have got sicker. And, you know, there's no right time for justice. It's always has to be the now. It has to happen now.
We're speaking with John Rayleigh and Scott Sexton of the Winston-Salem Journal. Guys, we're going to put you on hold for a minute so we can bring in Speaker Tillis here, Representative Tom Tillis of Mecklenburg County, who is, as I mentioned, one of the co-sponsors, a key sponsor of the current legislation that is about to be debated on the House floor in the next weeks regarding compensation for victims. So, Speaker Tillis, thank you for being with us. Can you hear me?
Yes, Julie. Good morning, and good morning, John and Scott.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I guess just before we brought you in, we were talking about how it's taken 10 years to get to this point. This is as far as a compensation measure has gotten in the North Carolina legislature for eugenics victims. How do you explain that? Why do you think it's taken 10 years?
I've finally concluded that it probably has to do with the tough decisions that we had to make. And we had, the past leaders were simply not willing to deal with the pressure that's going to come. And there, make no mistake about it, you would think that this would just be a huge consensus bill, but it's still not something that's understood by the general public. You have to make decisions about the compensation level, the scope of the program, and I just don't think that the prior leadership had the intestinal fortitude to take on the heat. And we do.
Now, there have been bills to do this in the past. Democratic Representative, your colleague, Larry Womble of Forsyth County, you haven't been a co-sponsor of those bills, though. So why this bill? Why weren't you signed on to those earlier efforts if you've believed all along this was the right thing?
Because I thought that the past processes and the past leadership, as I think Scott may have said, have just paid lip service to Larry over the past decade, and the bills were not going to go anywhere. And I, as a freshman in the minority, and I've been following this since I was a freshman in the minority, didn't feel like the past leaders were committed to getting anything done, and I think history has proven that out.
Do you recall the first time that you learned of the details of this program? I mean, what was your reaction?
You know, I wanted to ask John, I mean, John and Scott have so much value in terms of the history of this. I was trying to remember the first information session that I was aware of. I think it was the second half of my freshman term, and it was when Larry pulled people together to talk about the monument sign that's now down in Raleigh that memorialized the eugenics program. But it was the meetings leading up to the monument sign. I was there for the monument ceremony. So it's been at least 3 years. And honestly, from the first time that I was made aware of it, I'm not a North Carolinian. I've only lived in the state since 1998. And quite honestly, it wasn't until that time. But from the moment that I was briefed on this, I realized just what a wrong it is. And I do agree with Scott. I think every day is the right time for justice. And from that first briefing, I thought we needed to move forward on it.
And compensation was what you felt like needed to happen? I mean, is $50,000 the right amount?
Well, there's no right amount. That's one of the tough decisions, Julia. It's just making that arbitrary decision, knowing that there's no right amount. One of the victims who's been one of the most vocal, she and I are probably plus or minus a year the same age. So I've thought about, had I been forcibly sterilized when I was 13 years old back in 1970, back in the early 70s, late 60s, you know, I can't conceive of how I could come up with any number. That was one of the difficult decisions that we had to make, and I think it's one of the difficult decisions that the prior leaders didn't want to have to make.
You know, this ended only, this program, the Eugenics Board, was disbanded only in the mid-70s, 1974, I think.
Right.
Which, you know, isn't that long ago, as you're saying. Why do you think it was so quickly forgotten? I mean, how do you think it's possible that as recently as 5 years ago, this was like shocking news to so many people in North Carolina when it was the truth and the reality for so many decades in North Carolina?
I honestly do not know. I mean, it just seems to me that maybe there was embarrassment. Maybe there were a lot of people in this legislative body whose parents served in this legislative body, and aunts and uncles, who were actually a part of allowing this process to proceed. So I think there was probably some institutional embarrassment in there. And, it's just like one of these dark secrets that the family doesn't want to have let out. And I think we need to educate people so more people can understand how profoundly just what we're trying to do is.
Do you wonder, as you work on this measure to compensate these victims, do you fear that once the compensation happens, that again it sort of fades into history? And does that mean, I mean, could it happen again? We certainly see similar mindset in some areas of our society today. I mean, do you worry about that? Do you worry that?
Well, I actually, there are two primary reasons that are driving me to do this bill. One is to try and show respect to the survivors, the living survivors, and also to try and find some way to memorialize this. And the other one is to send a very clear message and have legislators take pause in decisions that they take that are such an egregious abuse of government power. So we can never know what future legislatures will do, but hopefully we can create a point in time in history where we looked back and looked at the decisions of prior legislatures and said it was so profoundly wrong that we felt like we needed to act. Not only apologize, but act in a meaningful way.
you have amassed quite a few co-sponsors to this measure, more than 50 from my count, both Democrats and Republicans. Has this been an easy sell at this point?
Quite honestly, I haven't reached out to anyone and asked them to co-sponsor it. They've done this on their own volition, and I'm very pleased to see that.
So why, you've spoken about your confidence that this can happen, that this can be the year that compensation is given to these victims. Are you still that confident? And why do you think now is different than, you know, is it because of you? Is it because of your involvement, you as a leader, a powerful member of the legislature, that this is going to happen?
Well, most people know that I'm not big on pressuring members into voting. I tell all my members, you vote your conscience first, your constituents second, and if those two aren't driving you, then you vote your caucus. And I don't see it really cutting along those lines. I think we'll have a strong vote coming out of the House, and I'm hopeful that the Senate, this is going to require leadership in the Senate, and it's going to require maybe not the same level of passion that we have in the House, but it's going to require people to be willing to step up and again, take the criticism that will come from people who I think simply do not understand the issue and the history. And if they did, then this should be one of the fastest pieces of legislation we could pass through, if they understood the fact.
It's passed through three House committees. When will we see it on the House floor for a full debate and a vote?
Well, honestly, I'm conferring with Representative Parman because I would be happy to honor Representative Womble and having him come in and take the vote. But I feel pretty strongly we need to move it quickly so it has adequate time to move through the Senate and get passed out before we end session towards the end of June.
Representative Womble, of course, is recovering from a really serious car accident, some serious injuries. So he has not actually been at the state capitol very much this session.
The only time he's been there was when we brought it up before the Judiciary Committee to fully debate the policy. He was there, and I understand it was a very exhausting day for him.
Speaker Tillis, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for covering this. We need to get more people educated on the issue.
That's Republican House Speaker of the North Carolina House, Tom Tillis, who is a key sponsor of the bill to compensate eugenics victims with a $50,000 lump sum payment for living victims. And it is currently working its way through the North Carolina legislature. Returning now to John Raley and Scott Sexton of the Winston-Salem Journal, reporters who did that original series, were on the team that published the original series in 2002 about North Carolina's eugenics program. John Raley, if I could ask you, how important was it to find victims who would be willing to tell their stories for the newspaper?
Just, you know, it was crucial, Julie. I mean, we knew that we had, you know, what the black and white figures, the numbers on the page were showing us was pretty chilling, but we knew it would be nothing without the faces to go with it. And one editor told us, you know, he told us the obvious, you got to find them, but he was saying some astronomical figure to us for this, like maybe 20 or something. We found in the end for the original, like only three. And since then, a lot more have come forward. And it was ideally suited to me, a dinosaur, and not really one of the internet age, because it was just a lot of shoe leather, a lot of just going through phone books and calling 20 numbers and finally hitting it, a lot of writing letters, and, you know, it took a while.
One of the first victims you interviewed, as you mentioned earlier in this program, was Elaine Riddick, who had since moved to Georgia. Do you remember what struck you initially about her? Was it difficult to get her to speak with you?
No, I found an address for Elaine. I wrote her a letter and said, would you please call me? And she called, you know, several days later. And it was kind of like she'd been waiting all those years to tell the story. And within hours, we're on a plane flying down to Atlanta with photographer Ted Richardson. And we talked to Elaine in her apartment for like 4 or 5 hours that day. And Elaine and I have been friends ever since. And I hope she's on right now. If so, good morning, Elaine.
We are. We're going to get Elaine on here in just a minute, but I did want to ask you, for you, John, how did meeting Elaine, spending those hours with her in her apartment there, how did that change the experience of this series, of this reporting project for you?
Well, I just, you know, she and Niall would become the whole anchor, and they still are, of the whole thing. I mean, other courageous victims have come forward, but Niall and Elaine had filed suits against the state back in the 70s, and they lost. I mean, it was kind of a rigged game anyway. Ever since then, they've been suffering in silence. And so what they told us, their revelations about being bullied into the sterilizations. With Niall, she was told, you know, if you don't do this, we'll take your family off welfare. Your brothers and sisters will starve. With Elaine, pushed and pushed, and they had her shell-shocked, alcoholic father, who didn't even have custody of the children, sign a consent, and her illiterate grandmother. So it was just... This just underscored the sham of the whole thing, and there was sham after sham to come, and it shattered my illusions about my state.
That's reporter John Raley of the Winston-Salem Journal, and we are so pleased right now to have with us on the phone from Atlanta, Elaine Riddick, one of the most outspoken victims during this entire process these last 10 years to get compensation and justice for victims of North Carolina's eugenics board. So, Elaine Riddick, hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and good morning.
You know, we've heard just a little bit from John about your tale, but it really is a heart-wrenching one. You were how old when you were sterilized by the state?
I was 14.
And why? What were the reasons that were given, and did you know what was happening to you?
I don't know why, but I know I was a victim of rape. They did not give me any reasons because I did not find out until like 5 years later that I had been butchered or sterilized.
So you were this young teenager who you had been raped and you, as a result, had become pregnant. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
So when you went in to have your son, who is also has also been very visible in this process in terms of advocating for you and for other victims, when you went in to have your son, you're a 14-year-old girl, and you say the doctor at that point, that's when the sterilization took place?
Exactly. No one has said anything to me or told me anything. All I know is I went in to have my son, and I don't know when I woke up, but I know my son was not there. My son had went home a week prior to me, and nobody told me why the bandages was on my stomach. And, you know, being naive, I didn't even ask.
When did you find out that you could not have children?
Well, it was a little process. I kept getting very ill because I didn't get any aftercare. I found out when I was 19 years of age. My husband and I tried to start a family. I got married at the age of 18. We tried to start a family at the age of 19. And I kept getting sick, not understanding why. But anyway, the doctor in Brooklyn had told me that, again, that I had been butchered.
You were in, where was this when you had your son? It was in North Carolina, right? Edenton?
Yeah. It was in Shawan County, Edenton.
So this was years later you were looking to have children and you just discovered. And did you know at that point that the sterilization had been ordered by an actual state-sanctioned board?
No, I didn't know.
When did you actually discover that that was, that had happened, that you were a victim of the eugenics board then?
Well, when I was 19 and the doctor, you know, tried to fix my tubes up, and when they went in there, they had found that my tubes were so severe. One was so severely damaged, they had to get rid of it.
We got to take a break. We'll come right back to you. It's WFAE, Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, celebrating 30 years of serving Charlotte with fine diamond jewelry, engagement rings, custom design, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Sharon Road, across from South Park Mall, and DonaldHack.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists will join Diane at 10 to look at this week's top national news stories. The U.S. economy grew more slowly than expected in the first quarter. Mitt Romney clinched the Republican presidential nomination on Tuesday with a win in a Texas primary. And a jury found former Senator John Edwards not guilty on one of the counts against him. And the judge declared a mistrial on the others. All those stories and more at 10 o'clock on the national news roundup of the Diane Rehm Show. Here on 90.7 WFAE.
Nothing from the Queen City is sacred when Charlotte Squawks comes to Booth Playhouse June 8th through 30th. Using songs from Broadway, rap, and rock and roll, this year's show takes aim at pop culture, sports, politics, and more. Ticket information is available at 704-372-1000 or blumenthalarts.org. WFAE is pleased to be a media partner.
Welcome back. I'm Julie Rose in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE. We're talking about the eugenics program in North Carolina, and we have with us Elaine Riddick, one of the victims of North Carolina's eugenics board. I'm so sorry to have cut you off right there, but just before the break, Elaine, but you were telling us at what point it was that you learned not only that you had been sterilized, but that it actually had been ordered by the state of North Carolina, by the board, the state-created board in North Carolina. What did that feel like for you to realize that you had, you know, that this had been some official order from an actual state agency?
Well, I don't know how I felt. I felt traumatized. But when I found out that I was, that the state of North Carolina had actually ordered the sterilization, I was devastated. I went to the American Civil Liberties Union who investigated what had happened to me, and that's when I found out that it was ordered by the state of North Carolina to do that. So what I did was I brought a lawsuit against the state of North Carolina for $1 million. I was totally, totally traumatized. I was humiliated. I felt degraded. You know, I just didn't want nobody to see my face.
What happened then in those intervening years? What was your life like after, I guess, when you were 19, you discovered you'd been sterilized, and then, you know, it was 30 years before John Rayleigh contacted you from the Winston-Salem Journal. What was your life like during that time?
Oh, God. I became a hermit. I didn't want to talk to people. I hid a lot. I kept running away from family members and running away from my own self. You know, I didn't like myself. You know, I thought that I had did something wrong, and I kept asking God, why me, why me, why me? You know, what did I do to deserve this? I felt like a wounded animal.
What was it that made you then, I guess, decide to open your door to John Rayleigh and the Winston-Salem Journal and their photographers and all of the publicity that would come of that meeting?
Well, I had to have counseling, of course, and I started, you know, coming out a little bit. And once John Rayleigh and the Winston-Salem Journal approached me, you know, it was a process. And through the process, I had to come to realize that I had not done anything wrong. I had to accept what had happened to me, and I had to work with it because I had to show North Carolina that I wasn't feeble-minded and I wasn't stupid, and what they had did was totally wrong, that nobody had the right to rob anyone of their womb. And that's what the state of North Carolina did to me. So I had to be a voice. I had to come out, and before I didn't even know that the state of North Carolina had did this to thousands of other people. But in the process, the more number, the bigger the number, and my realizing nobody was coming forward, I had to step up and step out. I had to stop wallowing in my own self-pity.
You mean there was a period there where you thought maybe you were the only one that this had happened to?
Yes.
That must have been so isolating to think that you had been singled out for some reason.
It was. As I said, I just felt totally degraded and embarrassed. But once I realized that it was a process that the state of North Carolina was doing, and that I was not the only one, and nobody was coming forward, and that gave me strength to speak out and try to get other people to come forward.
It's been 10 years since your face appeared in the Winston-Salem Journal with that story, so eloquently written, but also told with such such honesty by you. This last 10 years, what has this been like for you? You've been at every legislative meeting, every task force. You've been on every national television station, I think, out there. And I've seen the way that other victims who've come forward, I see how they look at you with such sort of gratitude and awe for your courage. But these 10 years, I mean, what has this process been like? Did you think it would take this long to get to a compensation bill like this?
Well, yes, no. At one point, I was hoping that North Carolina, you know, stepped up to the plate, and they did. You know, they're doing the best that they can. I thank the governor for what she did, and Governor Mike Easley. I thank him for, you know, initiating the whole process along with John Rayleigh and Representative Womble and Representative Palmer. You know, I didn't think nothing was ever going to come out of this, but now I see that these people are doing their best as far as the $50,000. I know she had to put in a number. And I knew that, you know, first I didn't understand why such a small amount, but she was trying to get something to compensate the victim.
And by she, you mean Representative Earlene Parman, also Forsyth?
Yeah, and Governor Perdue.
Governor Perdue, okay.
Yes. You know, it's been hard, you know, but it's been a struggle for me, of course, because my husband is totally bedridden, but I had to get out there. And I thank God that he allowed me to go forward with this mission. And another thing is that it's not going to ever stop, because we are not going to have to go back here again. You know, so we're going to make sure that this is an active, I don't know the word that I want to use, but we're going to make sure that government respect human life. We're not going to let this go to sleep.
You're saying you'll continue to be an advocate?
Yes, I will.
Against,
yes, I am.
This kind of program. So $50,000, if that check, as Speaker Tillis would like to see it, if that check is written to you, I don't know, does that heal you in some way?
Well, you know, again, it's the principle. You know I have to put my feelings aside. You know, it's not, it won't heal me at all because of, you know, the trauma that I had to endure for that $50,000. Nobody understands what was taken away. And $50,000, again, and I will always say this, would never, you know, it can never compensate me for what was taken from me and the humiliation that I had to endure.
But it does something for you, obviously.
Well, you know what it does? It made me feel, it made me know that I have been right all along. So there's some sort of, you know, consolation right there.
There are a lot of victims out there. We believe there could be as many as 2,000 living victims of the Eugenics Board in North Carolina, and yet only about 130 or so have actually come forward in the last year and a half to 2 years to get their records verified and get themselves, I guess, in line to receive compensation. Why do you think more have not come forward?
Well, you have to remember, again, how demoralizing this is and how, you know, embarrassing it is. I mean, my goodness gracious, people don't want nobody to know that they were a victim of the eugenics program. People don't want nobody to know that the state of North Carolina or other states, well, the state of North Carolina looked at them as being imbeciles or feeble-minded or, you know, to put negative labels on them. You know, it is devastating. I mean, it's still devastating to me to have to go up and put my face out there, but I have to do it because just to give them people hope. You know, I put my feelings aside and my emotions aside, and I just had to step up because if I didn't, my goodness, this thing would be continuing right now.
Elaine, I want you to stay on the line. I want to share a few comments we've received from the website from our listeners. You can share your thoughts with us if you're listening now at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And also, we should mention at this point that there is a state organization, a foundation. It's called the North Carolina Justice for Victims of or Sterilization Victims Justice Foundation. I'm mangling that, but it's a foundation of the state. And there is a hotline for victims in need of assistance, people who suspect they may have been sterilized by the Eugenics Board, and even family members who believe that maybe there's a family, someone in their life or someone who has passed on that may have been a victim of this. You can call toll-free 1-877-550-6013. Again, that number is 877-550-6013. And I do want to share with you a comment we received from a listener online. This is Andy, and he says, I heard the truth about the eugenics program trickled out due to sealed documents, which is true, and we can talk with John and Scott about that in a moment. I was a victim, says Andy, of the Murdoch Center. The reason I quit high school in 1977 is because my English teacher approached me with the amazement of my two-year stay at the facility, the Murdoch Center. John and Scott, I think you're with us on the phone. The Murdoch Center was a training school, right, for troubled youth. Was that it?
Yeah, something along those lines. And I've talked to a couple of victims recently that were sterilized at that place. And yeah, for state reform schools, it was almost an unofficial requirement for release in some of them that you had to be sterilized.
This listener, Andy, says, I thought I could keep it a secret by not telling friends or classmates for years. Then my teacher took me out of class to ask me questions about it. I was floored and I quit school that day. I cry every night looking back at that day. I remember everyone at the Murdoch Center and every horrifying day and night I spent there. I remember the doctors and even have a picture of me inside a chain link fence that my mother took. My comment is, those documents were everything but sealed. My English teacher found them quite easy. So you can hear the shame there, I guess, related to that experience. And just speak for a moment about the documents. I mean, there are records. The Eugenics Board in North Carolina kept records. Elaine, you've seen your own records from the Eugenics Board, have you not?
Yeah, a paragraph.
Oh, okay, okay. What do we know? I mean, are there records somewhere, John and Scott, that detail all of everything that went on?
Yes, we were fortunate enough through our colleague Kevin Bigos to have access to a lot of the records through his friend, the great researcher Johannes Schoen. But those records are not open to the public, and that was one reason Elaine and Niles' class action suits failed, is because the Eugenics Board just wasn't going to give up those records. And through victims have been kind and courageous enough to share with me their records once they obtain them. A victim can write the foundation and easily get their records, but much of them still are sealed.
We have a question here from another listener, Gina, who mentions that in Mecklenburg County, she says, I thought the main motivation for the policy was economic rather than genetic. Weren't all of the victims of sterilization on welfare and the goal to keep the welfare rolls from growing without the effort of curing the root causes of poverty? There were many reasons, were there not, for sterilization. And what role did the welfare system play, John and Scott, in North Carolina's program?
Julie, it became a garbled mess. I mean, it started out with this junk science of eugenics, to create this master race. But even from the start in the Great Depression, it was also rooted in the government was tired of paying for a lot of people. So they kind of merged together. I call it the three P's. You had this progressive movement. Then maybe it became kind of paternalistic. And by the end, when they're targeting black women and girls on welfare, it's pure prejudice.
Elaine, you were one of those black girls on welfare. Was your poverty one of the reasons that you were forced into sterilization, do you think?
Well, there was a lot of reasons, I believe, for me. One was poverty, and one was, you know, looking at my home background, my environment, you know, which the state failed to look at. So they created this their own stories about me. You know, you have to remember also that there was no work in the rural part of North Carolina. People had to go out there and work in fields. They said that at the age of now, they said that I had never performed a day's work in my life. You have to look at my age when they did this test for me. It was not for sterilization purposes. It was for orphanage placement, which they had administered that test to me when I was like 11 years old.
This was an IQ test you're talking about?
Yeah, so they took that test. I mean, and my IQ was low because of my environmental factors. You had to look at my alcoholic mother, my alcoholic father, shell shot, and you had to look at the abuse that was going on in my house and what the children was exposed to. There's a lot of factors with me. So I think one of the things with North Carolina and me was that I would never find out that this had happened to me. It wasn't so much as poverty. It was more of an environmental factor.
And yet someone did give approval. I guess it was your father and your grandmother. Have you ever asked your grandmother why she agreed to this?
Well, you have to remember my grandmother was illiterate. She had never gotten out of the first grade, so it was forced. How they approached my grandmother was wrong. My grandmother said that she didn't know that she was signing away my rights to become a mother. My grandmother had, she was, had never gotten out of the first or second grade. So when someone approached her with sterilization or tubercle ligation, what is going through her mind? She don't know those words. Now, my father, they approached him after the state of North Carolina had taken his children away from him because he was proven to be unfit. And my question would be, how can you go back to the same person that put the kids in this sort of environment and ask for permission?
John Rayleigh at the Winston-Salem Journal. Was Elaine's story, is this a common story in North Carolina's eugenics history, that there was some coercion and people were agreeing to something they didn't really know what they were doing?
Yes, as terrible as what happened to Elaine is, it's not uncommon. When you look back, you see record after record of people, of sterilization petitions being originated because so-and-so runs around at night, in quotes, or so-and-so is promiscuous, or this girl dresses like a boy, or their father is a dwarf. I mean, it's really heinous when you read them. This stuff chills you.
Elaine Riddick, thank you so much for being with us to share your story, and thank you for your advocacy on this effort.
Thank you for having me.
And John Rayleigh and Scott Sexton, reporters of the Winston-Salem Journal, their original series on eugenics has been compiled into a paperback. It's called Against Their Will. You can find details about that at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. John and Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you, Julie.
Also, thanks to House Speaker Tom Tillis, who was with us this hour. His measure, House Bill 947, is working its way through the legislature to compensate victims of North Carolina's eugenics program. Sending in for Mike Collins, I'm Julie Rose. This is Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.